Good morning. Any sound? Can you hear anything? Need some more? That any better? Can you hear that? Am I getting there? Is that okay? All right. I am delighted to welcome you back. Candy gave me a bad time this past week because I kept you late last week. I was not paying attention to the clock. I was having so much fun, and you were asking such good questions, and I'm supposed to let you out at 11 o'clock pronto. So I apologize for that, and I will be a little more circumspect today. Put my watch right there. No, you didn't, and that's my clue. Usually when everyone leaves, that's how I know that I'm supposed to stop, so appreciate that. But I know you don't have much time between this session and the next service, so I wanted to be sure to keep an eye on the clock. We are doing a series, as you know, on the historical context of the Bible. We're still more or less at the beginning stages of this study, looking for these several weeks at Egypt. So our concern is to do two things. One, just give kind of an overview of ancient Egypt and some of the historical outlines of that interesting narrative, and then especially to highlight those moments when Egyptian history intersects with the history of God's people. And so last week we looked at the first time, really, that you find in the Old Testament some reference to God's people and Egypt, and that is when Abraham had toured, of course, from Ur over in Mesopotamia up to Charan, and then he came down to Canaan following the call of God to go to that place, but he found himself in Canaan in the midst of a famine. And of course, in the ancient world, Egypt was something like the breadbasket of the ancient Near East, and so when most of it was struggling and fighting famine conditions, typically, Egypt still had grain, and that was because of the phenomenon that the Nile River tended to be famine-proof and would overflow its banks and water the surrounding region even when rainfall was reduced to nothing. Sometimes Egypt itself was caught in a famine, and we see something of that today, but nevertheless, on that occasion, Abraham travels down to Egypt, and as best we can guess, he meets Senusret III, the chief pharaoh of the 12th dynasty of Egypt, and we outlined that story just a little bit last week. So this morning we want to skip ahead. We're going to kind of pick up there and follow the story through to the next time that we find some kind of interaction between God's people and the Egyptians. And that, of course, is the story of Joseph, who was sold by his brothers as a slave into Egypt, and he finds himself once again there, basically in what's called Lower Egypt, Northern Egypt, probably under the regime that's associated with the Hyksos. So if you're familiar with Egyptian history, you know about them, Hyksos, and we'll take a little look at that and how that may have influenced the story that we find unfolding in the scriptures. But what I'd like to do to frame our conversation this morning is direct your attention to Genesis chapter 50. This is toward the tail end of the story of Joseph. I know you all know this story because you've all been to Sunday school, you know, and this is one of those favorite stories of Sunday school drama in which we find Joseph, of course, the favorite son of Jacob, doted upon by his father because he was born of Rachel, his favorite wife, and so on, and that did engender a certain amount of hostility and resentment and envy among the other brothers, the older brothers, who eventually had basically gotten to where they were fed up with this Joseph and his dreams and all of these special gifts and lavish kinds of goodies that were being piled on this one son. So they decided to take matters into their own hands, and they sold him, as you know, as a slave to passing Ishmaelites into the Egyptian region, and they assumed they'd never hear from him again. And in the ongoing story, the drama, of course, Joseph, after a lot of adventures and misadventures, finds himself as what's called the vizier, something like the prime minister of Egypt, which was a known office at that time, and clearly that was the position in which Joseph was installed. And it was on that occasion, in the midst of a famine, that the brothers show up. Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. And he jerks them around a little bit, you've got to say. You know, he's testing them. He wants to know if they're the least bit repentant over the way that they had treated him, abused him earlier. And so he orchestrates a situation that basically puts the younger brother of Joseph, Benjamin, into a similar posture vis-a-vis the other brothers as Joseph himself had once been. And he's testing them to see whether or not they've had a change of heart. Are they going to be as vicious toward Benjamin as they had been toward Joseph? And Joseph, of course, is able to satisfy himself that there has been a change of heart. He discloses his identity to his brothers. They are mortified, to say the least. But Joseph assures them of his forgiveness. He who now holds them in the palm of his hand, you know. And he yet nevertheless extends to them the most gracious forgiveness and mercy. But now the story that we find in Genesis 50, which I'm using to set a context for our conversation today, is after Jacob has died. And the brothers are fearful that the only reason Joseph has been nice to them is in deference to the old man. And now Jacob's dead. And maybe Joseph is going to see things a little differently. And now maybe he's going to exact his revenge. And so the brothers come to him, and this is the account of that conversation. So if you found your way there, it's Genesis, the last chapter of the book of Genesis. And we'll pick up at verse 15 and read down to the end of the chapter. This is the word of God. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong we did to him?" So they approached Joseph, saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him and said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." And in this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were also born on Joseph's knees. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will surely come to you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." So Joseph made the Israelites swear, saying, "When God comes to you, you shall carry up my bones from here." And Joseph died being 110 years old. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. So there's our text, and we'll be working around that text a little bit this morning as we proceed. Let's just have a word of prayer, and we'll get underway. Our Father, we are grateful for this remarkable and engaging story. We thank you that the Bible is filled with stories, and that those stories invite us to become players, to become participants in a great drama that you've been working out through history. And we're grateful at the same time that you've given each of us a story, and that the story has brought us here this morning to review this text, to be encouraged by it, and through all of this to learn to honor and worship and adore the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. All right. Well, we left off last week in the middle of the 12th dynasty, so we're going to start with a little bit more history, so fasten your seat belts, but the 12th dynasty is that dynasty which really was a high point. We talked about the pyramid builders. The pyramid builders were those who had been the original great civilization in Egypt, and then after that, it's as if Egypt kind of spent itself and went into what's called an intermediate period in which there was very little centralized authority. And then you come back to what's called the Middle Kingdom, and the greatest dynasty of the Middle Kingdom was the 12th dynasty, and the greatest ruler of the Middle Kingdom was Senusret, who we talked about last week. The 12th dynasty begins about 1991 BC. Abraham, to keep ourselves oriented to biblical history, is born around 1951 BC. So he's born in Mesopotamia just at the beginning then of this so-called Middle Kingdom, the 12th dynasty there in Egypt. Senusret III, that we talked about a little bit last week, rules from 1878 to 1841, and it is during his rule that we have Abraham arriving in Canaan, and it's, as we said earlier, the midst of a famine that drives him to Egypt, where he has this interaction with this Pharaoh. We were saying last week the likelihood is that Abraham arrived with some degree of sort of recognition. It wasn't just a wandering, isolated handful of people. It was probably several thousand people. And Abraham himself was viewed as something of a sheikh who desired a certain degree of professional courtesy. And it was out of that that the whole story that we hear of concerning Sarah, his wife, unfolds. Well, that's all taking place about 1875 when Abraham is about 75 years old. The birth of Isaac and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah take place about 25 years later, in 1851. This is still during the reign of Senusret, but to keep our eye on the biblical narrative, this is the, at least as best we can tell, the general chronological sequence of things. The next ruler of the 12th dynasty, and the last really important one, is Amenemhet III, and you have to practice saying that, Amenemhet. Amenemhet. I said that about 8,000 times this week, so I got it. Amenemhep. Missed it. The third. That's the important part. 1842 to 1797. Good-looking guy. All kinds of artifacts have been discovered representing this last great pharaoh of the 12th dynasty. He is kind of the last gasp of this particular era before Egypt once again devolves into this intermediate period. We don't have any particular reference to him in the biblical narrative, but he's interesting for a couple of little trivial reasons. He's the first pharaoh, for example, to build a labyrinth under his pyramid. Not much of the pyramid is left. It was one of those kind of mud brick affairs that doesn't survive the ravages of time very well, but by then people realized, these pharaohs realized, that tomb robbers were out there, Laura Croft and others, they were out there, and they were raiding all of the wealth that was being entrusted to the pharaoh at the time of his demise, and these pharaohs were smart enough to figure out that that wasn't helping them much if they lost all this to tomb robbers, so Amenemhep III seems to be the first one to try to fool them, and he builds more or less a rat's maze under his pyramid. It didn't work. They still found it, so the best laid plans. This is the time frame in which Abraham sends Eleazar, his steward, his chief servant, to Haran. And you recall the reason he did that was because he wanted to obtain a wife for Isaac, who is now about 40 years old. It's time for the boy to get married, But Abraham doesn't want Isaac to marry a local girl. These Canaanite women were idolatrous, and Abraham, as was the custom at that time, wanted Isaac to marry within the family, a cousin. And so he left a lot of family back at Haran. We talked about that a few weeks ago. And so now he sends Eleazar to that region to find, of course, a wife for Isaac, and Eleazar is successful, and the name of the wife is Not very robust out there. The name of that wife was? Who is that? Rebecca is right. So Rebecca comes back and marries Isaac. And 20 years later, you have the birth then of Jacob and Esau. That 20 years, of course, represented a time of some grief because it was hoped that she would bear children much earlier. If you recall the biblical story, you know that Isaac prayed, he interceded on behalf of his wife Rebecca, and then as a result of that, there was a divine response in some form or other that came to Rebecca that two nations were in her womb. There was a war already going on in utero. And this, of course, would become thematic for a great deal of the rest of biblical history. But the birth of Jacob and Esau then takes place in 1791. So we are now into this time in which we see the end of the 12th dynasty of Egypt and the beginning, as I say, of an intermediate period. This period is called the Second Intermediate Period. It's quite important because it's during this time frame, 1782 to 1750, that Joseph is sold as a slave into Egypt. And so from a biblical point of view, we're interested in what exactly is going on in Egypt during this period of time. It is first and foremost a time in which there is decentralized authority. There is no one great pharaoh ruling over the entire land. Lower Egypt and Upper Egypt are divided, and indeed even among them there are competing claims to the control of the region. So that's the first thing that we want to notice about it, and that's the reason that it's called intermediate. That's the term of art that's used to describe such a political arrangement. The first dynasty that we're interested in is the 13th. This dynasty is in the south, what's called Upper Egypt. And dynasties 13 and 14 run concurrently with the 15th and 16th dynasties in the north. So you've got stories at both ends of Egypt here. We're going to look, first of all, at this one briefly in the south because it sets up a couple of things that will be of interest to us. For one thing, this seems to introduce a time in which the pharaoh is no longer a hereditary office, at least in the south. Usually, the pharaoh would leave control to his firstborn son, and that would be the continuity that would be put in place. But it seems to be at this time that actually the pharaoh becomes, now this is speculation, but some have suggested, virtually an elected office. And the real power shifts from the person who is the pharaoh to the guy who sort of kind of functions like the prime minister. He was called the vizier. And this is a arrangement that develops in the south but moves eventually to the north. And the story of Joseph is a story of a man who rises from somewhat obscure beginnings to become this vizier, this prime minister. That's the only way really to properly interpret the story is to see Joseph as being installed in that position. Well, this entire arrangement, the very idea of having a vizier as such with such sweeping authority, really originates at this time. It originates in the south, but it kind of works its way up to the north where Joseph would have found himself a few years later. This is a time, in any event, of dramatic decline in Egyptian authority. Central authority is gone, and it's really a time when it's not chaotic, but certainly a time in which you have local control, more or less setting the pace for the political life in Egypt. Now, during this time, there is a group of Semitic, sort of quiet invaders, and they're called in Egyptian history the Hyksos. Nobody knows for sure what their particular origins were. I think the best guess is they were, again, Amorites. Now, we talked about Amorites a couple of weeks ago. They were the ones who infiltrated themselves into Mesopotamia and eventually established a city at Babylon, out of which the king Hammurabi eventually emerged. You recall all that? There will be a test. You got that, don't you? Well, it may be the same Amorites. They were kind of people that wandered around. They appeared a little bit rude to others who observed them, but they were pretty smart. And they may have also done something like that, kind of insinuating themselves into northern Egypt, coming across the border and more or less ingratiating themselves to some degree to the native Egyptian population. The Egyptian priest scholar Manetho, who we rely on quite a bit for some of this history, says they came in with violence and force. But generally speaking, Egyptologists these days think Manetho is overstating it, and that actually they didn't come in with some sort of great dramatic invasion, but rather just were sort of quietly moving in and working their way into positions of some prominence. What happened was that during this time of intermediate sort of devolution of central authority, it seems that somehow or other the Hyksos were able to more or less begin to dominate the political life. Now, the 13th dynasty we're concerned about in the south, the 14th is virtually unknown to us. It's very obscure, very short. Some think it didn't even happen, but for now we're going to stay focused more on the north. The Hyksos were Asiatic or Semitic. They are not native Egyptian. They migrate in during the latter part of the 12th dynasty. There's quite a bit of sort of artistic description of these people, a lot of it, in fact. If you're familiar with the way that Egyptians would portray themselves, then you'd notice immediately that these Hyksos look different. Their hair is different, their dress is different. The fact that they are associated with livestock here is, again, a distinctive about them. And there's quite a bit of points where these people were quite different from the native Egyptians, but very similar to the Semites who lived in Canaan and in other parts of the Near East. And what's interesting to us, of course, is that Joseph is a Semite, you see. And many have speculated that part of the reason Joseph was able to be catapulted into such prominence was not simply his ability to interpret dreams, which was pretty impressive, but because also there was a shared common heritage between the Pharaoh who was ruling at the time and Joseph. They were both Semitic. Doesn't mean they spoke the same language, but they shared a kind of common cultural heritage that would have helped them understand each other. And it may be that the Pharaoh's willingness to trust Joseph as rapidly as he did was driven in part by the fact that he recognized in Joseph something of his own heritage. That's speculation. We don't have that stated certainly in the Bible or in Egyptian records, but triangulating what was going on, it makes a certain amount of sense to see it that way. What happens is with the collapse of central authority, these Hyksos begin to exercise greater control, and the 13th and 14th dynasties in the south, therefore, take place concurrently with the 15th and 16th dynasties in the north. And the 15th dynasty especially is called the Hyksos dynasty. It is later hated by the Egyptians. They despise the idea that foreigners were ruling. And so the Hyksos are eventually driven out, and their memory is largely expunged from the records. But nevertheless, we've been able to uncover enough about them to have some idea what was going on. And that's kind of the basic political backdrop now for Joseph coming to Egypt. It's during this period of time. So it's an overlapping dynasty with the south, with Upper Egypt. It's a time in which these kings were called the Hyksos or shepherd kings. That itself would be unusual because the Egyptians prided themselves more for being agrarian. They were proud of their grain crops. That was the focus of their wealth-producing capabilities. They did, of course, have livestock, but they tended to boast in a different kind of enterprise. But the Hyksos were associated with being more of a kind of livestock-oriented type of population, which again would fit more with their kind of Semitic background. Specific records concerning the Hyksos era are scant, spotty, incomplete. Two reasons for that. One, the Hyksos themselves were much less interested in leaving archives for the ages. The Egyptians kind of liked it. They had that sort of religion of timelessness. The pyramids and their structures generally stood for an idea of leaving a record of their exploits that could be read by people like us several thousand years later. The Hyksos didn't have that cultural heritage. Most of what they built was mud brick It didn't survive very long, and that's part of the reason we don't know much about this period. The other is because the later Egyptian rulers wanted to get rid of all memory of them, and that didn't help either. So on two counts, we kind of lose a lot of the detail that would have been associated with them. We do know this, that if we go back to the very earliest period of this Hyksos era, then it puts us in about the year 1720. That's when the Hyksos were more or less arriving in some force and beginning to make a visible expression of their presence there. And it continues until the year 1570. That's a pretty firm year. That's the year of the rise of the 18th dynasty and the so-called New Kingdom. It's under the 18th dynasty that the Exodus takes place. So we have quite a paradigm change from the Hyksos era earlier to the 18th dynasty and the pharaohs that were hostile to Joseph and his memory that come in the beginning part of the 18th dynasty. So this is the time we're interested in. As I say, the internal history is not well known. You read Egyptologists on this and they'll say they've got some names of pharaohs. They can't give real good information on the dates and so on. But what I'd like to do is overlay that era then with what's happening in biblical history, and especially the story of Joseph. So let's just work through this. This is familiar to you. This is Sunday school material, but hopefully you recall it. And I'd like to put some dates on some of these events. Jacob flees from Esau, going back up to Charan in about the year 1720. Now, you may recall he was born in 1791, and that may make him a little older than you were expecting at this point. Remember, he lived to be 130. And if that chronology is correct, then this puts him in kind of his middle age. He's still young. He's still more or less in his prime, even at 60, 70 years old, you know. I mean, hey, I'm 60. So that's the way it is. And he, much more, I'm sure, than I, was in this prime of his life. But he does have this falling out with his brother. Esau and Jacob had been tussling with each other from birth. Jacob basically swindles Esau out of his birthright when he sold him a mess of pottage, you recall that. And then some years later, he is able, under some kind of subterfuge, to also get the patriarchal blessing. And Esau, that was it, you know, enough of this guy. Jacob realized that he was in trouble, and so he flees with not much more than the clothes on his back and heads north back to that region of Charan, where there was extended family still residing and so on. So that's going to take place about 1720, about the time that the Hyksos period is beginning in Egypt. We have Joseph taking off. He's there for about 20 years. You recall the story. He works 7 years for Rachel, and then he gets Leah. So he works another 7 years for Rachel, and he gets Rachel. He probably got her earlier than that second seven, but nevertheless, the story. And then he's another 7 years there working for the wages that eventually are paid to him in the form of livestock and so on that are given to him basically as a result of his labors. And God blesses him richly. And so he leaves then after some 21 years a wealthy man. Just before he left, we have the birth of Joseph. Joseph is born of his favorite wife, Rachel. You know the whole story. He fell in love with Rachel, but she couldn't have any children, it seemed, for a long time. So Jacob had children by the concubines, by Leah and so on. But eventually, toward the end of this era that he's there with his father-in-law, Laban, he does have a child by Rachel, and that child is Joseph. So he's born about 1700, thereabouts, and that's just before Joseph now leaves Charan, heading back for Canaan. He's fleeing from Laban because Laban is pretty resentful of all the blessings that have befallen Jacob, and it seems that anything Jacob does is blessed and so on. You recall all of that, and so he has to leave more or less under dark of night. Laban catches up with him. They kind of strike a truce. And there it is. Jacob returns. He wrestles with the angel. You remember that story at Peniel? Wonderful, rich story with deep significance that we're just bypassing for the time being. And then he, of course, reconciles to his brother Esau, and that all takes place in about this time frame. All right, if Joseph was born in 1700, then at 17 years old, which would be 1683, his brothers sell him as a slave to the Egyptians. This would be right in the middle of the Hyksos era. And so we would understand that Joseph now is showing up at a time of decentralized authority when Semitic rulers are controlling Egypt. And that, of course, in itself should at least suggest to us something of how God in his providence is preparing the way and making a way for the drama that's going to unfold. Joseph shows up in Egypt. Of course, he's sold into the house of Potiphar. He is probably quite well educated because growing up in the environment which he was part of, there would have been a very heavy emphasis on being well educated, and probably as a slave that distinguished him so that fairly quickly he was able to move up the ranks, you might say, of responsibility in the house of Potiphar, who's said to be one of the commander, I guess you'd say, of the guard associated with the household of Pharaoh. And so he's there probably for about 10 years. At least we understand he's not quite 30. If he went to Egypt at 17, he's 28, maybe years old, and he's falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. He had grown from being a teenager to being a good-looking guy, you know, 28, 29 years old. He became the object of the desire of the wife of Potiphar. She makes solicitations toward him, to his credit. And somewhat shocking to most men who ever read the story, Joseph rebuffs all of that and runs for cover. And of course, as a result of that, she is angry and she accuses him of attacking her. You know the whole story. He winds up then in prison. Nevertheless, after a couple of years, he is once again put in a position of kind of control, of some authority, even in the prison, even as a prisoner. He interprets the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker to the Pharaoh, and that gets him into the court of Pharaoh to interpret dreams that Pharaoh himself had had. And so this is all taking place about the year 1670. We're told that Joseph was 30 years old when he became the vizier of Egypt. And so at least by that reckoning, we'd say the date was right about this time. We don't know what Pharaoh it was. It's almost impossible to reconstruct the particulars of the dates of the pharaohs during this time. And so we just have to leave that to open speculation. But in any event, Joseph is installed in that position at that point. Shortly thereafter, we begin to have the unfolding problem of the plagues. Not the plagues, the famine. Keep your story straight here, Gore. The famine, that 7 years of it, of course, as you know, that comes in. It's 7 years of plenty. I'm getting lost, aren't I? This is 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. You got that? Scratch from the record what I just said. 7 years of plenty, which Joseph has just predicted. And as a result of that, there is a accumulation of grain. God blesses Egypt abundantly, and Joseph is in the position of storing all of this away in anticipation of the famine that's going to come 7 years down the road. So this seems to be taking place during this period of time. Back at the ranch, in the south, the 13th and 14th are over, and the 17th dynasty starts. Remember, these are concurrent. The 17th dynasty begins to develop some traction. This is going to be in 1663, right at the tail end of these years of plenty, and it may very well be that it was in part the plenty of those years that gave them the ability to start establishing some horsepower, and they are eventually going to be those who drive out the Hyksos. And so these in the 17th dynasty now are beginning to have designs on reuniting Egypt under one great authority. So that's happening in the south. In 1662, the following year, we have the beginning of the 7 years of famine recorded in Genesis 41. Joseph's family moves to Egypt in the year 1660. You know the story, I reviewed it briefly a little bit earlier. The brothers come down, They are discovered by Joseph, and of course the interaction that takes place there is a lot of fun to read. But the long and short of it is that we have the whole family, Jacob, all of those who are associated with him, maybe several thousands of them, move to Egypt, and they move into a region called Goshen. Goshen is part of the delta region at the very north of the Nile as it flows into the Mediterranean Sea. It was the richest, most comfortable region of Egypt, and probably even under famine conditions, it would have been a fairly comfortable place to live. And so it's here in Goshen that the Hyksos, who controlled that region, permit Jacob and his family to live, and they live there for some time to come. It's always been a very interesting question, is there any archaeological evidence of a Jewish population living in that region dating back to that time frame? And there's been all kinds of attempts to discover whether there are some evidences along those lines. It's rather ticklish to engage in this kind of investigation because, generally speaking, Egyptian political realities are somewhat hostile to attempts to vindicate the Old Testament record in ways that either favor the Jewish tradition or favor Christian tradition. Egypt, which is largely Islamic, as you know, generally doesn't like good press for Jews or Christians, you know. And so when archaeologists come in with the stated purpose of wanting to vindicate the Old Testament record, they run into difficulties. It has not been impossible, it has been difficult. Nevertheless, there has been a fair amount of what I think is fairly exciting work that's been done in the last 30 to 40 years in this region of what's called Goshen. And so there have been discoveries that have been somewhat interesting, and I think from a Christian point of view, very encouraging. One of the most interesting of them is the discovery of a kind of peculiar architecture, which is unknown to Egypt, but common in later Israel. And the architecture would involve a kind of horseshoe-shaped structure, such as is pictured here by an architect's drawing, but you can see the distinctive character of it. It would have a kind of large dwelling area that forms a horseshoe, and then out in the front of it is a courtyard. That was a very distinctive Hebrew architectural design. In fact, some of the stories in the New Testament presuppose this particular arrangement. You recall the parable Jesus tells of the rich man and Lazarus. And the picture there is the rich man is having breakfast, you know, eating a Danish and drinking coffee and reading the Wall Street Journal. And at the gate, visible to him, but just outside, would be this poor man Lazarus. He's essentially on the street, but he is in a situation where he can see. And it says he would be happy to have some of the crumbs that fell from the guy's table, but he was not permitted to enter. You know, that story presupposes this kind of arrangement. When Jesus is on trial, the home of Caiaphas was arranged this way. So Peter is in the courtyard outside warming himself as Jesus is being, you know, carried back and forth from one room to another in this sort of railroad trial that's going on. And that's why Jesus could actually look Peter in the eye while Peter is outside warming himself, because Jesus is being taken across that courtyard from one room to another. The point here is, you don't find Egyptians building houses this way, but we have found in the Delta region there this kind of distinctive architecture, and at least suggests that there was a Hebrew or at best a Semitic population that was there, and it dates back to this time frame. So I think those who watch these things are quite intrigued by it. All right, so this takes place in 1660. 1646, at 130 years old, Jacob dies. Jacob has been reunited with his son, thinking he was dead. This is a wonderful reunion and a wonderful kind of change in all of the expectations that Jacob otherwise had. And so those last several years, we can be happy about the way in which the life of Jacob wound up being much better than he had certainly anticipated. A few years later, in 1590, Joseph dies. This is 110 years old. You remember he was born in 1700. Now he's dying in 1590. The Hyksos are driven out by the 17th dynasty in 1570, only 20 years later. And that is a great change in the political environment of Egypt. We hear that the first pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, it says a pharaoh rose who did not know Joseph. You know, well, it isn't that he never heard of Joseph. That was fairly recent history. He didn't know Joseph in the sense of having any regard for him or respect for him, because Joseph was Semitic, Joseph was associated with the Hyksos, and all those Hyksos were hated. And part of what the new dynasty wanted to do was get rid of every memory of the Hyksos, get rid of every favorable comment about them, and pretend it never happened. And so the 18th dynasty represents a dynasty of deep hostility, not only to the Hyksos, but to the remaining Hebrews, who of course were still in Goshen and now become the target of a very different political attitude as they begin to be reduced to slave status. And that slave status is going to continue for another 100 years or so. The Exodus will take place in 1450 in round numbers, and this dynasty comes in at 1570, so it's about 120 years later or so that we have those events taking place. So this is kind of the basic lay of the land, and I'd just like to come back to the text that we were looking at and comment briefly on it in the few minutes that we have left. You recall what Joseph says to his brothers. His brothers come to him, and they are in fear for their well-being. They think that Joseph is now going to exact from them the penalty that they richly deserve to pay for the way in which they had abused him earlier. And Joseph makes a most remarkable comment at that point. He says, "Wait a minute, guys, am I in the place of God? I know you did me dirt, but what you intended for harm, God intended for good." And that's become one of the most important verses in all the Bible, a kind of almost classic reference to an idea which is sometimes difficult to wrap our brains around, but is taken for granted biblically, that God can use even bad circumstances, awful events, wicked, horrific kind of, you know, strategies of man to accomplish his purposes. And that was exactly what happened with Joseph. You just think, what if you'd been in the shoes of Joseph? You talk about getting yanked around by circumstances. He gets sold as a slave. He finally is able to recover from that, and he gets falsely accused by Potiphar's wife and winds right back up in prison. And the ups and downs, the kind of back and forth experiences he had must have made him wonder at times, is there anybody up there? Do you see what I'm going through, you know? But when he could look at this at the end of his career, he could see that everything that happened, even those things that at the time seemed so impossible to appreciate, how could God bring any good out of this? If you're being hauled away and thrown into prison, how could God bring anything good out of this? He can now see at this later juncture in his life that even those things were being worked by God for good, so that he can say this rather profound theological truth: what you intended for harm, God intended for good. Same Hebrew word. Meaning, God is not simply in the business of damage control. This wasn't simply God bringing some good things out of bad situations, sitting up in heaven going, "Oh, what am I going to do about this?" and trying to fix things and try to bring something good out of a bad situation. This isn't what God is doing. God intended these bad things for good purposes. We sometimes get disturbed by that ethically because we think, well, the ends doesn't justify the means, and that's exactly what's happening here. The reason ends and means ethics don't work for us is because we can rarely correctly predict the ends that will be produced by our means. We are finite, we are limited, we don't have the ability to predict all of the vicissitudes of circumstance. So if I try to bend the rules today, thinking that some good thing is going to happen tomorrow as a result, that is presumptuous in the extreme. I'm much safer to simply do the right thing and trust God. But if you happen to be God, then you can, in fact, orchestrate both ends and means. And you can use the very evil intent of a wicked person to accomplish a glorious conclusion. Now, my friends, some of you are in the midst of difficult, hard circumstances. I don't know that by looking at you. You look fine. But you know, and I know, that in every one of our lives, there are things right now where you're asking yourself, how could this possibly be of any good? You're thinking that. Something may have happened in the last week, and you're going, this possibly have any use? Trust God. Learn from Joseph. What somebody may be intending for your harm, God is intending for your good. Amen? You know? And so look with thanksgiving on these things. Exercise that wonderful biblical commodity of faith that says, even though I don't see those ends, nevertheless, I see the God whose hand is working in these circumstances by his providence to produce them. And every one of you in this room who's been a Christian for a few years knows how you can look back on hard moments in your life and see today how what seemed at the time an impossible situation was used by God for some good end. And today you're grateful for it, even though at the time it seems hard to believe that you ever could have been so grateful. What man intends for harm, God can intend for good. And that, I think, is the great lesson. I think this whole chronology of the story of Joseph helps us.